Thou living room's dark, save for light being cast from the big TV screen and the imminent sunrise that's teasing the one starry sky with whispers of morning.
Hey, Mike.
Hello. I'm going to speak on this one.
Yeah. Yeah. One of our listeners was actually just commenting the other day that you hadn't participated in an episode in a while, to the point where she forgot your name. And George was like, he's on every episode. How can you not remember the man's name? That's rude. Yeah.
I'm just very patient. I'm the not that I'm super old, but I'm the old guy in the room in the corner that suddenly decides to speak. And everyone gets real quiet and like, what is he going to say?
Old man Mike is talking. This is the antithesis of a hot take, right? Like you're very measured. You spend hundreds of episodes sometimes thinking
a very cold and dead take here.
So what game did you decide was worth you speaking up for?
Well, the surprise whiplash announced release of Metroid Prime Remastered, a game that came out over 20 years ago.
Yeah,
so it meets your threshold.
Yes, it meets our threshold.
Yeah, our threshold. need to take ownership.
We were talking about some contemporaries of this game, and because it's first-person shooter-ish, we'll get to that in a second. This game came out a year after Halo, so when you think about FPSs in like the 90s, you think about keyboard and mouse, right? Because you want all of the affordances of that. So before anybody goes like, well, but it was a GameCube game a year after Halo, just to center that in your mind. Let's see. I'll do the quick stats. So this was a host request from a Michael Edwards. the release date for this, November 18th, 2002, again, a full year after Halo Combat Evolved came out. This was on the GameCube originally. We, of course, played the Switch remaster, which before we agreed that that was okay, we sort of checked a few boxes and made sure, like, it's mostly visual. They didn't change any of the core gameplay. They didn't fix anything that was wrong. They didn't, you know, massively enhance anything that was right. Like, it is the same kind
of
criteria.
Other than one category that's a main feature of your show, but we can still speak to.
Fair. But they, this passed the same test as like playing Diablo 2 remastered, which is if the game part sucks, the better graphics are not going to save it, right? So yes, the graphics are better, but the game underneath is the same game.
It's the game looking back at us through its nostalgic goggles and saying,
there you go.
This is who I always was.
which direction do you push on the C-stick to get to the nostalgia goggles? Which visor is that?
Which of the eight cardinal directions?
Eight cardinal directions. So quick summary. Metroid Prime takes place between the original Metroid and Metroid 2, The Return of Samus.
Oh, lore.
Yes. Well, you know, you got to know some lore. This game has like more lore than most of the other Metroids combined.
I know. I have a lot of thoughts about that.
Players control the bounty hunter Samus Aran as she battles the space pirates and their biological experiments on the planet Talon 4. Also, it's in first person, the first game to do that. Since exploration takes precedence over combat, Nintendo described this as a first-person adventure.
It has not caught on.
Yeah. But also...
The faux pas? Is that what that would be?
It's so Nintendo. It's so Nintendo to be like, we don't want to admit our game with guns is a shooting game.
It's actually kind of Apple-like, too. It's their courage, too.
You gotta have courage
to not give you a dual stick option.
So tell me, what was your nostalgia experience for Metroid Prime?
I was front seat ready for this to happen when it got announced, and like I was here for this game when it came out. I was following video game news. I was super excited. it was kind of a big deal that Metroid skipped the N64 generation, which with even more hindsight is like probably wise.
Was Samus Aran's only presence on the N64 Smash Brothers?
I'm pretty sure, unless there's some weird pinball game or something, but I think that was only on portable. So
yeah,
I feel, yeah. And yeah, I don't even, like, after Super Metroid, I think it was Fusion and this came out like as the, okay, she's back kind of.
Oh, right. Game Boy Advance games.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so you had waited, essentially, from your point of view, an entire console generation for another Metroid game.
Yeah, and it was a big deal, like, how are they going to handle doing this in 3D? And, of course, this way the show exists, we'll have lots of thoughts about that. But, because, yeah, Metroid had never done anything 3D other than, well, it's not 3D, but Mode 7 making Ridley zoom into the screen, I guess.
That was very swooshy-wooshy. So at the time, right, we're talking just your nostalgia experience, at the time, were you, like, did it live up to the hype? Were you satisfied with all the buildup?
Yeah, I was super excited that it looked like they actually tried to make Metroid, that it wasn't just a generic Space Marine shooter. I don't think Halo is a generic Space Marine shooter, but I do think they're, you know, to maybe a slight counterpoint to that level setting is, yeah, Halo was amazing when it came out, and most of the status quo was not.
That's fair, especially for consoles, right? Like, part of what made Halo Halo was that it was mouse and keyboard levels of possibility with your thumbs, right?
And yeah, what it's doing with multiplayer and vehicles and inside and outdoor spaces, fluid, like, remarkable achievement for 2001 or whatever it came out. So we're going to spend the rest of the episode on Halo now because
surprise,
I decided, but no, yeah, super excited. I was already a huge Metroid fan at the time. Metroid is like a weird cousin to Zelda. It's not as puzzle focused. We'll talk about this too more later. But it does share some traits in the sense of your limitations that you gradually gain more access to the world. But it's got some pretty serious differences too. But it's got some of that Nintendo DNA of backtracking a bunch of interesting items and remixes it.
Well, it's got, I mean, in my mind, and probably in the minds of a lot of people now because of the way history has borne out, is I think of Metroid as Castlevania in space. Right? Mm-hmm. Because once Symphony of the Night came out and Super Metroid and Symphony of the Night share a lot of DNA, that was just what everyone decided that was now a whole genre of video games, right? And Metroid does have a lot of backtracking and it does have a lot of that stuff, but like that was new-ish to Castlevania until they did Symphony of the Night. And then
it was a level-based game before then.
Right. And then they just decided that that's what Castlevania was forever now. So like it is interesting to see what that explore the world, go around, you know, spooky environments is like in 3D, because it does feel more personal. I will say for my part, my nostalgia experience this game is I skipped it on purpose. I don't remember thinking about it this clearly at the time. But the idea of doing the kind of world exploration and navigation you have to do in a Metroid game, in a Metroidvania, seemed like it would be horrible in first person, right? Mm-hmm. Also, as you have remarked as we were prepping the show, like, I'm not huge on first-person shooters, so I would have, that like also would have scared me off a little bit from wanting to play this at the time. Since then, I have come around on them a lot, and there are good ones and there are crappy ones, right? Like, Doom 2016 was amazing, and I enjoy the Borderlands series, and I've played all the way through Halo, which is, you know, old at this point, but still, like, got all the important bits right. So I can't, at this stage, say, like, first person is a reason a 3D Metroidvania can't be good, right? Like, that would have been a limitation on my end at the time, but I do remember my friends that had GameCubes being like, oh my God, man, Metroid Prime, this game's so amazing. And I was like, I'm going to just go over here and play Super Metroid for the 80th time.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's weird. I think this might literally be the first game we've reviewed where it's like my whole experience is intentionally not playing it.
Yeah. I do think even at the time, and maybe even still now, it's a pretty unique part of the Nintendo family. It's the most, probably one of the creepiest and most air quote mature games they make. It doesn't have any real human violence or any sexuality or anything, but it is like the most moody, least likely to be for young children game they make, for the most part, especially in 3D, just because of the immersiveness. And, you know, the commercials at the time were like, could have been a trailer for like an animated Alien sequel or something. Like, it was just like, it was part of their, back when Nintendo tried a little harder to be like, we need teenagers to think we're cool. And I don't think it worked, but it's but at the same
time,
they
really have endlessly grappled with that. Like, we want to be mature and cool, but we also want to be young and fun and hip. And like, mm-hmm. the Disney Corporation does that by owning multiple brands, but Nintendo doesn't do that.
Yeah, they put a disguise on the publisher so that you don't associate them. But yeah, and but you know, the game itself isn't thirsty like that. It's just kind of is what it is. It feels kind of authentically itself. But yeah, I don't know. We can get into it.
Yeah, let's get shilling out of the way real quick so we can actually get this review rolling. If you like what we're doing, you can give us feedback on the website. You can subscribe. These are great ways to support the show. I am still on some social media, but I don't support it because social media is generally bad for you. So feedback form on the website, still the best way to go. I do stream most of the games we play on Twitch, including I think 3 or 4 streams of this. So you can see that I really played it, that we really play these. If you want to go above and beyond a little bit to support us, you can leave a rating and review on the Apple Podcasts or wherever. I know there's other places you can do it too. But honestly, the best thing is just like tell a friend. Like if you listen to an episode and you're like, oh, I love this game and I like this critique, just give them like an easy in, right? So direct recommendations of episodes, I think, is even better than a rating and review. If you want to go crazy, you can support us on Patreon. Everybody who supports on Patreon gets the after show, no matter what level they support at. And because George has laryngitis, he unfortunately won't be able to do hilarious nicknames for all of our supporters. But I do still have to shout out our 8-bit classics, Jacob, Yarno, Jason, John, and Kevin, and our 16-bit hero, Michael. Not you, Michael, different Michael. We could do this without you, but as I always say, I don't want to keep supporting us. Now we can talk about the audio visuals for the Metroid Primes.
You mean the blue and the orange?
You know, you sent me that picture of like all of the movie posters that are all blue and orange, and I was like, oh no, this is going to corrupt my perception of the visuals. But actually, once I started playing the game, it didn't seem as heavy-handed. And like when you're looking at stills, like right now I have a bunch of reference images set up and it's like super heavy handed, but in situ, it doesn't feel too bad, which is good.
And there's good science behind the blue and orange choice. Maybe science is a little strong there, but yeah, this game is very blue and orange. Samus is orange, aside from some suit changes. Your HUD is very orange. And then there's a lot of blue, especially like shiny parts of the interface are very blue. Doors are blue. And, you know, this makes basic sense for contrast. It's easy to see. That's partly why so many color grades use it in movies and film, because human skin tones, very orange, whether, you know, bright or dark, it's still very much on the orange line in your color spectrum. And then,
is this, you're a video person, is this like a serious color contrast? Because I feel like the meme you sent me with all the movie posters, like none of those were comedies, right? Like those are all serious movies and this is a serious game.
Yeah, I mean, more serious, like, we want to define serious, but like when movies have heavy color grades, and I guess, you know, a serious drama might be more likely to have that kind of color grade, you tend to have more two-toned color grades. And so, yeah, you might pick a blue and an orange to you got to have a skin tone unless you're David Fincher and everything's yellow always.
You got to have a style when you're and David then Fincher.
You're going to pick something to offset that skin tone. And if you're going for contrast, it's going to be something orange or something bluish. So it just kind of works out, like the math works out that that's a good pairing in most situations. It's also pretty natural, a blue sky, human skin, like it's just kind of a thing. But, you know, there's obviously a lot of nuance when you're applying it. This game, it's pretty, you know, pretty saturated orange. And those blue doors are really brightly blue. But, you know, it's a whole planet and they do the Nintendo thing where there's a whole bunch of different seasons are represented by the different zones. So you have
that's true.
You have a green planty place. You have a deserty place. You have a snow
ice,
place.
Ice level, underwater yeah. level. So yeah. Yeah. They deploy, it's the full Mario treatment.
Yeah. And so they deploy all that. So you get that. So when I say blue and orange, I don't mean there's no variety in this game. But in terms of like the tech overlay and a lot of the signals the game is giving you about what information is in front of you, a lot of that is contrasting using those colors.
When even the like the magma pool,
caverns. Yes,
Brinstar. even that area is almost all orange because the floor is literally lava, right? And the rocks are all kind of an orange color. But I feel like they still make it navigable mostly with like shifts in brightness. Like the lava is very bright and the stone is like very dark. So mm-hmm. even though they're kind of in that same color area, it doesn't feel washed out. And then when you shoot your little pew pew blaster, because it's lit in a different way and it's not universally coming from the ground like the lava is, then you still can like track where your shots are going, right? So even in an environment where there's a lot more orange than in some of the other environments, you still feel like you can navigate and make out details and stuff, which is good because this world is lovingly rendered. Like I know yeah. we played the remaster again, but like the variety and the detail is crazy, even for the GameCube version, just absolutely bonkers.
Yeah, it's for a GameCube game, it's gorgeous. It's 60 frames per second, even in the original. It's a rock solid, I'd say 99% of the time frame rate. And in the new one, I think it is like pretty much 100% of the time. So it's smooth. It's, you know, one thing I really noticed having played the original is the precipitation was like very large and busy on the original, like the snow, like the blurry spheres of snow in the GameCube version. It's all been made so much more subtle, which might not only be more realistic or just cleaner, but it's also just way easier to see now when you're in the rain or in the snow. And you know, unless your gameplay is really going for inclement weather as an aesthetic, you probably don't want the feeling of like I can't see anything because you're
like the fog in Silent Hill.
Yeah. And I didn't mean to turn into like a color correction webinar, but that's also what this is now. But you know, like you were bringing up how you can have a lot of orange, but there's still other ways to vary something besides hue. So you can have the same hue or a similar hue, but you've got the luma, the brightness of that hue, and then you've also got the saturation to play with. So lots of ways to still make something that's easy to look at, even if it's multicolor or one color.
Well, and they do some, not to, you know, get into gameplay too early, but they do a lot of game stuff with the colors, right? Because there's the things a person like you notices because you deeply understand some of the choices that are being made. There's the things a person like me notices because I kind of understand the choices that are being made. But then there's the things that people need to notice, even if they don't understand anything, right? So, like, there's a lot of little, I don't know what you would call them, like, mining lights. It's like a garden light, like a light on a stick, like, stuck in the yeah. ground. And, you know, you can't freely climb all over the wall. It's not Breath of the Wild up in here. So, like, you kind of need to know where platforming can happen. So you'll be in a dark area, but there's like a little splash of light over there to like maybe mm-hmm. get your attention, right? Or the when you are in like the scanner mode, like the things you must scan are red and the things you can optionally scan are orange, right? There's a lot of like blue and orange within a single boss fight where it's like this color that's grabbing your attention. If it's like the more prominent color, like that's the one you have to pay attention to because that's like where they're shielded or where they're vulnerable, right? So they're they use like color and light to direct you around as masterfully as the like environmental kind of vibes you get from like where's what's in shadow, what feels like dark and ominous, and like what's, you know, color graded down so it's like kind of muted and spooky. And like you need the first one, you need the gameplay one a lot more, but you I think you enjoy the game more if it's got both.
Yeah, and you know, I think one of the core aesthetics of Metroid, to use a phrase I hear George say constantly and I don't speak about it until now, but is the moodiness, like, and not even necessarily story or lore, but just the mood, the loneliness in Metroid. And you know, one of its obvious in hindsight but not necessarily super direct references is Alien. And I mean, that one of the main bosses is Ridley. It's Ridley Scott. It's just a reference to the director of Alien. But and even though we don't have xenomorphs in this game, there's kind of, I mean, Ridley is a little xenomorphish.
And yeah, the long like pterodactyl head from the side is very much that same pill shape.
And while James Cameron's Aliens is an action, it's a Halo, basically. the original one is a spooky, lonely space station thing. So, and so that's just really important to your second point about how it's not just information for gameplay. It's also that that mood. And I do think Metroid without that mood might still be fun, but it would be not nearly as delightful to me.
One of the places that I noticed that that I think is like really subtle and you could see it a thousand times and never notice it, but once I noticed it, I was like, oh, I love that they included that, which is if you aren't moving actively for just a couple seconds, because you are in a first person camera, basically all you can see is like the HUD elements, right? The inside of Samus's visor, right? So like your map, which is, it's diegetic because it's literally the stuff that's like on her visor that she herself is looking at. But then her arm cannon takes up like a huge amount of your field of view, right? Like it's, and this game was originally 4x3. The remaster is, thank God, 16x9. So like you do have some more peripheral vision, which is nice. But if you don't move for even just a couple of seconds, her idle fidget is she rests her left hand on her, the top of her arm cannon in kind of like a, steadying herself, like try maybe not letting the paranoia creep in because she's been standing still and nothing's been happening long enough that like, what do you have to do, right? Like she's just thinking about like, where's the next monster gonna come from, what's the next challenge I have to overcome. So it's just this little tiny detail where she just puts her hand on the back of her arm cannon and kind of like drums her fingers like just a little bit, but it really lends to that mood of like, oh, she is a super badass, but this situation is very scary, right? Like she's able to deal with it because she's a badass, but she's still alive because she recognizes the threat exists. And yeah. I love all of these little touches that are throughout this version of the game or this version of the character. When something really bright flashes in the environment, like if a bomb goes off or some of the enemies, when they die, they explode. You can see her face reflected on the inside of her visor and she looks pretty emotionless. Like she is there to do a job, right? Like stoic. It's not like they forgot to animate her face. Yeah. But super stoic. When you know, she famously does not talk to silent protagonist. Cause who would she talk to? But when you get super low on health, even though there's the obnoxious suit alarm noise, you can hear her breathing heavily, and that's the only sound the character makes other than I think when you take fall damage,
yeah, you cry out or get
hurt. Yeah. So the only noise she makes besides I am hurt is I am tired. So it's like,
you don't even get an intro. The last Metroid is in captivity.
Oh man, you're right. Is there literally no spoken dialogue in this entire game?
No.
Huh.
And there's I'm trying to think, there's no, like, other than space pirates making little noises, like, there's no conversation. Like, some of the later 3D Metroids have, like, the equivalent of the Chozo on one of the other planets. I can't remember what they were called, but they, like, there's, like, a ghost that talks to you, and it's, like, a whole, like, there's no voice for it, but it's just, like, very, I don't know. I love that this game, you are alone the whole time, other than dealing with the environment or dealing with predators in the environment.
Yeah, or reading people's logbooks.
Oh, God.
We gotta, I want to talk about one other visual thing that I have a note for, and then we have to talk about the audio. I was a little disappointed. Like, I was sitting on the couch playing one night, and I got the boots, and I turned to Susan and said, the space jump boots. I got space jump boots because I can hear the space jump in my mind. Like, I know exactly what that, like, the whooshy when you first jump, and then when you get space jump and it makes the kind of, like, electrified, like, wah, 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 right? Mm-hmm. Like, that noise is just burned into my brain. And I got the boots, and then I jumped, and you double jump, right?
Yeah.
So, like, you can jump, and that's fine, and then you can double jump, and that's fine. Like, that unlocks a bunch of stuff. It's a double jump's key point of a Metroidvania game. But I was a little disappointed that a casualty of the move to first person was we can't flip the camera around 1,000 times while you're jumping, and it would make no sense if canonically she is flipping but the camera is not rotating. So
yeah,
that kind of bummed me out.
Yeah, and I think in the later ones, there were special spots where you could space jump and keep jumping, and it would switch to third person. And that was just like, I guess you solved it, but this is still not delightful because, you know, when you see a big sign saying space jump here, like, it's just, it's not the same neutral exploration expansion.
Right. And you don't get that problem with the morph ball, because when you go morph ball, it also goes third person, but you can do that at any time. So it's not like, oh, because the camera went into third person, I guess I'm supposed to use the morph ball.
Yeah. And some of that casualty, to get to the sound side of what you're talking about, is like, they don't embraces cartoonishly large of sound effects. They do for some of the beams, but like Space Jump, it's like, it's the same, like, you can hear like the air valve going in her suit or something for like whatever's pumping.
Yeah, I think the little, it's a little thing like on her back, right?
Okay, it's like a little thruster or something, but
I think, yeah.
And so it's like, it's pretty, and granted, you're going to hear it 500,000 times, so you don't want it to be like a Final Fantasy VIII summon every time you use it, but it's still like kind of like, weren't, weren't.
Yeah, they have to trade out the noise you make for the noises in the environment, because you need to hear what's going on in the environment, right? When those little bat things that like drop down and then launch at you, they kind of make like a chittering noise. The little things that crawl on the ground kind of make like a rustling noise. And if you could hear, because I mean, she's inside a spacesuit, right? Like, if you've ever had a diving mask on or anything, if you could hear what she is probably actually hearing, which would be, because she's like, got to be freaking exhausted.
Very proximity effect, self-breathing sounds.
Yeah, it would not really lend to the gameplay. I mean, I guess maybe the suit has like external microphones.
She's got a good transparency mode on it.
Yes, noise canceling Samus Aran helmet. Yeah, so I get it. It probably is. You buy it on Etsy for $1,000.
Before we do any other sound, I do want to say the design of Samus looks great in this game. Her suit looks great. As it gets upgraded, or when you lose is it Varia or Varia? I don't know.
I always said Varia.
Okay. When you lose that in the beginning, it is like, oh, she looks dumb now. Like, they do.
Yes. That abilities is very good at its job, because I don't even like the way she looks. Like, not only do you lose all of your powers, but I was like, eh.
Glad it's first person, because gross. But, you know, when you get each upgrade, like, pretty much straight through the game, I'm like, oh, that looks cool. Oh, gravity suit. That purple looks awesome. And then you get the Phazon suit and it's black and you're just like, oh, yes.
Yeah. Yes. No, they made the no powered up suit so lame so that every single upgrade feels like you're just going to increasingly like legendary armor. It's so, and like you said, it's first person, right? So, we didn't mention, but like this game has a bunch of little cinematics, like little, when you get a power up, when you go into a new area, there's like a little third person, you get to kind of see Samus like looking around and stuff. And so you actually don't see the suit from the outside very often. In fact, other than save points and those little cinematics, the elevator, that's the main time you see her third person.
And that seemed like a very intentional, like, we need to show her when we can, because... Right.
We spent all this time on this model.
Because it looks awesome, and also that's how people are used to, like, this character is getting to see it. And so, yeah. But, yeah.
No, I did have the same feeling when she gets off the ship at the... Like, when you land on Town 4 after the abilities, and you've lost all your powers, and I was just like, womp womp.
Yeah, and so, I mean, that's part of the Metroidvania... aesthetic is driving that desire for upgrades, and we'll get to the gameplay stuff, but any other visual stuff? I thought the door signaling was, I mean, it did its job well.
They just flat out tell you when you're looking at the map, like you either know what opens a door or you don't. You never have to experiment. If it's not filled out on your map, you do not have the thing that opens the door.
And if you fire on like a missile door and you don't have missiles, it'll just be like, you can't open this. Like it will, it won't let you waste time thinking you're just not hitting the right spot on the door. It's just like, you can't do it, buddy.
Oh, that is actually I'll save that for when we get to gameplay, because it's visual, but it's the visual only exists to serve the gameplay. It would be otherwise completely cartoony on its own. We should talk about the soundtrack though, because yes, it's banging.
Great soundtrack. The menu music. I love it. It's moody. Every zone has its own music, and I pretty much like it's more hummable than most Marvel movies. I know there's a whole thing about why we've probably talked about it before, but
I think we have
why that music is not hummable anymore, but very, very symphonic and like memorable, but also appropriately moody for each different zone.
Well, they save the more obvious tunes for boss fights, combat encounters, and like real combat encounters, not when there's wildlife that is dangerous, but like when there are conscious beings trying to murder you. So you not only get to not be overwhelmed by it because it's not just like driving guitars all the time, but it allows you to sink into the moodiness more, right? Because like you're coming down off of the emotional high of like, oh, the space pirates were just trying to murder me. And now the music kind of dies out. And it doesn't die out to a different piece of like hummable, you know, toe-tappable tunes. It goes into that kind of like moody atmospheric thing, right? Which like can actually like over relax you. So like you get super hyped up and now you're maybe calming down too much, which then creates tension because you're like, oh, I got to stay alert. So it's, yeah, the soundtrack is just, I was blown away because that is not something, as far as I know, that any of the earlier 2D Metroids did, where in and out of combat you get like combat music.
No, it was just the music bed of whatever zone you're in.
Yeah, and then
great
boss
music
fights.
But yeah, it doesn't respond to situations as much. You know, and like going to that cleaner, more atmospheric pads instead of like busy music that's kind of in your face, it just creates space for, you know, all the different creatures that make very identifiable noises for the most part. I knew if it was a wasp versus a ground bug, like just by sound, if it popped up behind me, I knew which one it was just by the sound. And that was good information signaling just through sound alone. I hate those wasps so much.
God, they're so fast and there's so many.
Yeah, I like the first thing I do in the game is like, can I missile these nests every time I'm in a room? Like, I don't want to shoot a bunch of you forever.
Can you? I didn't. I just
Did you never missile a nest?
No, because the most of the rooms that have nests are not platforming challenge rooms. So I would just I would just shoot two or three and then move on before a bunch more spawned. Because I think they will spawn infinitely.
Yeah, unless you destroy the nest. Yeah, they'll just keep coming. Which is very Metroid with like the healing up before a boss, shooting the plant pot bugs. But
yes. Yeah. Yeah. Here's an infinitely spawning enemy for you to drain life out of.
Who's the bad guy? All the different beams have, you know, reasonably different sounds to them. You know, I think they did a good job on like the, I don't think I have any serious complaints about anything sound related in this game. I think it's done excellently. Did you have anything that?
No, nothing honestly really negative, because I think sound design, whenever your game can accurately be described as spooky, is, whether you know it or not, good sound design must be happening, because you can't, like, if you played Bubblegum Pop over this game, like, it wouldn't be spooky anymore, right? It would be like happy murder lady in space. Like, she, you know, she'd be bopping around these different biomes, just stabbing space pirates with her arm cannon and laughing her way to the bank. Like, it wouldn't have the same vibe.
Yeah, getting sex.
I mean, it might still be fun, but the vibe would be so different. So I think, like, there probably are things in here that are not ideal or that weren't perfectly executed, but
I do have one I'm going to save for gameplay, because it's about the gameplay, but it is sound related. So
yeah, but generally, like, they have to be batting at a high average, right? They got to be doing way more things right than things wrong. Otherwise, all of the stuff we've been talking about by the mood, I don't honestly think it can be supported by visuals. I don't know what it is about spooky sounds.
No, sound spooky does sounds. So much work for how someone feels about something. I mean, most TV shows are telegraphing exactly how they want you to feel through the sound at all times. Feel sad now. This is funny.
Have you seen the thing, or maybe you recognize it on your own, in the beginning of the movie, The Social Network, with the audio?
No, I don't remember the beginning.
So in the beginning, he basically the inciting incident, as the movie frames it, is he is going to go back to his dorm room and be sad and invent Facebook because he got dumped by the girl, right? And in the original draft of the movie, the script calls for this kind of like poppy, like, oh, hey, like, we're going over here because it's college and some, you know, the adventure's just getting started. And there was a cut of the movie that it wasn't released, but like that has the poppy song that's playing.
Third Eye Blind.
I mean, yeah, something early 2000s college-y, right? And then what actually made it into the movie is like the drone from the opening of The Dark Knight, because what's about to happen is not good, right? Like, what's about to happen is probably objectively bad, and so the sound design is used to create a sense of foreboding, not a sense of adventure. And it's like, whoa, from that's like the second scene in the movie, and they are telling you everything you need to know about how you're supposed to be feeling in this one choice to not have Bubblegum Pop playing underneath him walking back to his dorm.
So getting dumped is the Hitler failed art school for Mark Zuckerberg in that movie, at least.
I mean, in the movie, yes, because he wasn't actually dumped. He was a piece of with a long-term girlfriend who he then married. So movie Mark Zuckerberg still has a terrible, I'm a whiny, weak man reason for being terrible, but at least he had a reason. That's right. I'm talking to you, Mark Zuckerberg, you piece of
You'll have to at least bleep that.
All right, now we can talk about the gameplay for Metroid
about
Prime.
Halo? Metroid. Okay.
Video games? Yeah. I believe we considered pivoting to Halo.
Good. Gameplay is why Nintendo exists, so this is the only category that matters for Nintendo games. The rest is nice to have.
Where do we start, though? Do we start with the shift to 3D? Do we start with like the way the exploration works in a 3D environment. Do start with platforming is still in this game, despite that being the worst possible choice they could have made when they shifted 3D. Like, which aspect of the shift to 3D is the most worth starting with? And why is it the bad platforming?
Well, I mean, I think it's we were gonna have to do all those things, but you know, it's being the first 3D Metroid. The question I'm most interested in is comparing 2D to 3D. What did they keep, and how did it go?
And totally fair.
Yeah, and so like, I mean, we can break that down on so many levels, but you know, Metroid is, you know, it's hard to call it a Metroid game to me if you're not exploring a large map where you can't go very many places at first and throughout the, you know, this Metroidvania definition. But the way that happens in a Metroid game is an evolution from like Doom, where it's like, you don't have the right key, find the key. And even though it boils down to that, it's very often, at least in the best Metroid games, it's something you feel in your abilities, not just, oh, you don't have the thing in your inventory, so no. It's like, you can't jump there.
Would you say that's an exploration thing and a combat thing, right? Because like, you need the blue key to open the blue door in the original Doom. That is its one and only function. But you need the spider ball to get across this room filled with lava. May also be how you interact with a boss, or may also be how you, you know, slip through this hidden passage in a room and avoid like having to blow up the turrets that are in the ceiling. Yeah. So like,
or you had to struggle through with bomb jumps for an hour and now you never have to do that again. It's like a capitalism selling you a convenience back after making things terrible. That's a good feeling once you get that ability. So yeah, it's definitely richer when it's multifaceted. It's not just blue key opens blue door. Yeah. It's great when it splinters into like, oh, there's 10 things that are different or better now because of one ability change.
Do you think the shift to 3D changes any of those? Like any, because this game still has the, I guess, familiar power-ups. Like, there's a bunch of new ones, but like, yeah, Morph Ball's here, the double jump is here, the different beam weapons, they even have the same names, right? Like, there's a lot of the same familiar powers. Like, if you went from Super Metroid directly to this game, because I actually never played I don't think I played either of the Game Boy Advance ones, but if you went directly from Super Metroid to this, you would not feel lost, right? Like, there's a bunch of new stuff, but do you think there's any powers that like made the jump to 3D particularly well or particularly poorly?
I think of it in terms of, so I mean, we can also talk about the Mega Man X first stage of the game, teaching you things.
But the landing site. Oh, you mean like the little pre area where you have all your stuff?
Yeah, and just that whole initial space station level is really a tutorial, and you know, it's your first chance to go, how is this going to work in 3D? And what problems did they have to solve to try to translate these familiar, you know, mostly familiar Metroid? I don't think they didn't really invent very much. And the things that are different, like the different missile types, they kind of just amount to, hey, this bullet sponge dies faster. Like, it's not really a gameplay change. And you know what? Like, what are the abilities that are really any different? I mean, conceptually,
visors have a bigger emphasis, right? So in Super Metroid, you have the scanner visor that you can't move while you're using, which is really obnoxious. But I think it also stops time, so like enemies can't move either. Because it's first person, they decided to really lean into that. So you have the combat visor, the scanner visor, which is probably deserves its whole own section, and like it's a way you interact with the world. And then the thermals, and then the last one is the X-ray. Mm-hmm. And so like that would be, you could still do that in 2D, right? Where you could just say like, oh, now all the colors are different, including Samus, even though technically you're seeing things through her eyes. This is how the world looks.
Yeah.
But in first person, it's way more like, oh, I have literally changed the visor on my helmet.
It's like in movies when people are in their own flashback memory and it's like, you're in your memory? How does that work?
How did you get here?
All of my memories are out of body experience. But yeah, I think of it that they, what's interesting to me is they translated most, I'd say a pretty, the Venn diagram is not that far off in terms of like a bulleted list of what can Metroid, what can Samus do? You know, I saw a funny joke that at the end, spoilers, at the end of last year's Metroid Dread, you have a Metroid suit, so you might finally be able to say, why can't Metroid jump or whatever they say.
That is literally the only reason that part of that game exists.
Yeah. Anyway, they ported almost everything over, and the interesting question to me is, what did that cost? What did they have to invent to make that work? And is it still fun? And I think you can go case by case and be like, yay, nay, kind of on it. And we should.
So here we go.
Yeah, so like, yeah, visor, like, pretty much an optional thing. I mean, maybe there's like a key moment in Super Metroid. I can't remember if it's absolutely required, but like, aside from maybe that, you absolutely never need that X-ray visor at all.
No, it's mostly to find missile upgrades.
And so that is, you know, suddenly been promoted to like the lens through which everything happens in this game. And so it's like a pretty dramatic promotion of what was a pretty minor element of Metroid before. So that's a pretty dramatic change. And I get why, because in 3D, they're trying to give you tools to manage the complexity of 3D. And some of that is, you know, what can I interact with? Well, just give me a visor that just says, here are the four things in the room that like mean anything. And to your point about color coding, and here's the red one. So yeah. If you're just here to get out of this room, go to the red one, and then you'll get the little puzzle solved, even though it's not a puzzle sound. And then the door will open or the fight will start or whatever it is.
Every time I shot down a stalactite and it made the you solve the puzzle noise, there's that one room that has like four of them in a row you have to shoot down, and it does the little noise for each one. And it's just like, stop it.
These little meaningless trophies. And like, you know, like, I like this game. Not to spoil, like, where I'm going to be on the end of our episode. I haven't said how many monocles are involved. But, like, there's a cost to going to 3D, and that cost is complexity and time. And so, with any communicating what is in a room, like, they've deployed all these extra solutions to... They could have just thrown you to the wolves and been like, figure it out. And it would have been like the Braid guy, whatever his puzzle 3D game where it's like, I'm not helping you.
Oh, the Witness?
Yeah, which that is one? Fine, because you buy into that going, I want hard puzzles and don't help me. And that's fine. That's like the contract, the social contract. But Nintendo, you know, famously doesn't play that way. Before Breath of the Wild, really didn't play that way, if you've heard of Navi. But so, you know, you think about the complexity of a Metroid environment. In 2D, it's like there's some enemies, there's some doors, there's a few tropes around like, oh, you can bomb walls or floors and like find secrets. But it's all... They don't have to like stop and explain. And in this game, as you pointed out, you enter a new area. It's giving you like a drone flight through it before you can even play. And, you know, it's popping messages over doors you can't open. And it's like it's going out of its way to be like, here are the puzzle pieces in this room. I want to make sure this is where you are and this is over here. And I'm going to move slowly and like... That's fine, like that's maybe even necessary, but it slows it down and it makes it very different from 2D Metroid, which can kind of just zip through what you're doing.
Yeah, I had my version of having that thought was not directly about the puzzles, but it was, or not as broadly about the puzzles, it was like more specifically about the scanner at all, because I like... The first time I fired the game up, I think I was playing it on stream, And so, you know, I'm seeing this stuff for the first time, like never played this game, intentionally pass on it. And so like I scanned a couple things and I was like, oh, okay, this is neat. Like you can scan some stuff. And then I got to like a door I had to open, like a force field I had to bring down to like get through. I was like, oh, I got to scan it. Oh, I have to scan everything. Right. And so like, I kind of had this like moment of Metroid Dread where I was like, oh no, that took longer to happen than I thought it would. Am I going to find this to be like an absolute chore? And so the game, and I think this may actually be unique to the remaster. So I just want to couch this. The remaster has a bunch of like bonus crap you can get through from the title screen. Right. And so as you're going through the game and you're scanning stuff, it tells you when you get to like a significant percentage, like you've scanned 25% of crap. Good for you, champ. Right. You've scanned 50% of crap. Good for you. But because the scanner targets are color coded, I could have decided right then and there, red things only. Like, I don't care about logbooks. I don't care about this. I don't care about that. But what they do that I think is a nice little nudge in the, hey, the game might be more playable if you scan some orange stuff, is if you scan a boss or an enemy, it tells you how to deal with that enemy, right? Because this is like, I guess basically 100% of the UI in this game, other than like the pause menu, is diegetic, right? So like,
yeah,
the scanner is literally her suit, which has like the onboard intelligence, like helping her do her job. So if you're smart or you've played the game before and you already know how to deal with this boss, you don't have to scan it. If you're a big dumb dummy like I am, you scan it and then you have some information that helps you be successful, right? So like they basically said, here's the stuff you must scan. Here's the stuff you might have a strong urge to scan because it's beneficial. And then there's the other 80% of the crap. And that is the right ratio. That is, yeah. It is a good balance.
Yeah, I think they made good design choices on it, but it still has to exist.
Yeah, and it does still slow you down.
Yeah. And so I think that's just one of the trade-offs that I, you know, and I think maybe 100 times out of 100, you'd make the same trade-off, but it's still a trade-off this game has to make to do this in 3D. And, you know, they lean into it well. It matches the idea of her having a high-tech space suit. It matches the world they're in. Like, it makes sense. So it's not, like, jarring that she can scan things. It's just not really that fun, and I don't really want to sit and read everything in the game, and thankfully I don't have to. And yeah, they've done those cues so I can skip most of it, so yay, thank you. But
well, do you think, I hadn't thought about it this way until we just started picking it apart, but so this game, the remaster that we played, the thing that made me, before you even reached out, go, oh, maybe this will be the time I finally play Metroid Prime, was because in the launch trailer, the announcement trailer, they were like, hey, twin stick. And I was like, oh, okay. We'll talk about whether or not that actually manifested in a way that's meaningful. But at the time on the GameCube, even though the GameCube technically had two sticks, it didn't. It had one, and then it had the C stick, which is not the same thing as dual analog sticks, right? But what having the scanner gets you out of is having a separate interaction button. You have a single all-powerful interaction thing. It's how you unlock doors. It's how you make elevators move. It's how you learn about enemies. It's how you do everything. Every damn thing is done through the scanner that isn't shooting. So that is the same kind of, what would you call it? Like reduction in complexity of controls that the single analog stick is.
Yeah, and what you made me think of was, aside from Terminator 2, are there very many protagonists that shoot doors open?
Yeah, oh god, I hate to admit it, but I've been playing Metroid games for so long, it kind of never occurred to me how bizarre that is.
It's so weird, and that's day one, 1986 or whatever, NES, that you shoot doors open, and they've, well, like...
In the NES game, wasn't it like you were shooting the door open because the door was like an alien bubble
like biological.
Yeah. But in this one, it's like, this is just a door that is opened by missiles for some reason.
Yeah. And at least with the missiles, you're like blasting off like a protective cover. But like, yeah, the other doors, it's like,
yeah, the ice door.
It's just so, so gamey, so staring you in the face and saying, I'm a game right now. And it's fine, but that's like quite literally the Doom key door kind of thing.
It totally is. Yeah.
Because it, other than gating off areas by a beam you don't have right now, it does nothing else. There's no other function or.
You know, I had an idea about that and it didn't pan out and it made me sad, which was. You know, because you'll say, you know, there's you have your four different beams. So there's like four different kinds of door that can be there. Plus, I think there's the general door. So five doors, right? I had this theory because there was a couple areas that I'd backtracked through like a million times because I kept dying and it was driving me nuts. But I had this theory like, oh, they gate the weapon you need to use to get into this area with, say, the ice beam. But then. Once you're in the area, some of the doors are wave beam. Maybe that's so you know that the enemies in that room are enemies you need to use the wave. It doesn't work. It does not hold up. It doesn't hold up. Sometimes it does, but I think it's just a coincidence, honestly, because there's only so many guns, right? But I was like, oh, this was an opportunity to like make the player feel smart. It's like, oh, mm-hmm. I use the wave beam to open the door. I already have the wave beam equipped. And so now when I get in there and a purple space pirate drops from the ceiling, look at me, I already have the wave beam equipped. But no, it's just coincidence.
Yeah, it's really, it just becomes busy work of like, I got to open. And like, other than the initial unlock, I don't think Super Metroid ever did any of that. It's like once you like open the super, or like maybe it relocked them to the same thing.
So
the super...
If I remember correctly, once you turn a missile door into a regular door, I think it stays a regular door.
Yeah. The power bomb ones, do they become regular doors or they stay power bomb doors? I don't know. Maybe they were inconsistent, but
yeah.
It's fine. It's not hard to switch beams. It's just kind of just part of the fabric of the world, but
well, the fact that you have to switch is actually something they changed, right? Because in Super Metroid, the beams stack. So when you get the ice beam, you now have your beam plus ice beam. When you get the wave beam, you now have your beam plus wave beam plus ice beam, right? Mm-hmm. And that was something I became intensely aware of because this game includes baddies that require only a single kind of weapon. Like their armor is they're all Achilles. They have their one and only one weakness, which... This is the visual note that I said I would save for later. When you fire the wrong beam at an enemy, and they're color-coded, so it's super obvious, right? It's not like it's not a complicated puzzle, but when you fire the wrong beam and it goes cartoonishly ricocheting off of them to make sure you saw that they did not get hurt and that you need to switch weapons every time, I was just like, you know, in Super Metroid, I could just basically fire all my beams at once.
Yeah. Is it more or less irritating than the tink sound in Mega Man letting you know you did not damage this thing?
I mean, visually, it is the almost exactly the same, right? It's like your lemon goes flying off into space. Yeah. But I don't know. This was a difference. This has nothing to do with 3D. They could have done this in a 2D Metroid, but I don't think that they have. I don't think none of the 2D Metroids that I've played do the beam color door and the beam resistant enemies. And frankly, I just found it a chore. It's just like they wanted to make the C-stick feel really cool and valuable. And so they're like, oh, you're going to have to reach up there to like change your weapon. Look at how quick and easy it is. And it's like, you know, it's quicker and easier not having to change it.
Yeah. The easiest edit is the one you didn't have to make, but yeah, and so like I mean that's part of the managing complexity of this game that ultimately just brings it down a notch for me of like even though it's I think they made lots of pretty good choices all over the place and we should get into more of those
uh we also have good things to say.
I mean this Metroidvania genre, it's about scaffolding all those abilities. And so, like, you know, there's a few good examples where you're in a room and you're like, oh, that energy tank up there, I can't reach that. And, oh, there's this over there, or I can't jump this high or whatever. But I feel like it's not quite as visceral and often, other than in like the arbitrary ways where it's like, well, it's a purple door. It's not like, other than jumping being something that gets unlocked, there's a lot less of that like natural feeling of like, someday I'll be able to fly there. And it's a little more like, they locked the door, sorry, buddy.
Well, they, something they were able to do in 3D that they couldn't realistically do in 2D, not in quite the same way, is you get the boost for the morph ball. And when I got that power, I literally said out loud, I was alone, and I said out loud to myself, like, what? So like, I'm going to go on some bodacious half pipes? And that is actually what the game calls them. In universe, it calls them, it's like, look out for half pipe geometry or something. And I was just like, are you kidding? It's just, and so there's, you know, the world, because this is the, you know, one of the Chozo planets, and it's dilapidated because the sickness came and just murdered everyone. And so there's a lot of nature, but there's also like super advanced technology just like around in this like ruined state. Plus the space pirates are here. So like some of the technology is being used because they're like trying to do stuff with it and figure out how they can become more powerful space pirates. And you have this very interesting set of environmental like mixing between the technology, their culture, and the like nature that has started to reclaim the planet. And then these perfectly smooth, perfectly laid out half pipes, because they don't want you mashing yourself against random slightly vertical surfaces to see if you can go up them. So they make the half pipes really obvious, but that makes them very silly.
And it makes them trivial. Like, you don't get a player satisfaction out of quote solving that. And
no puzzle.
And even though like Metroid has never been a puzzle first game, but the puzzles in this game are not really puzzles. They are, can you read 1, 2, 3? Okay, now hit 1, 2, 3. Thank you. Good job. And you're just kind of like, all right.
Well, so I would say in a 2D Metroid, the puzzle light is there because what you're really doing is making sense of the world as you explore, right? Like,
yeah,
the whole world is a kind of puzzle that you're trying to like grapple with, less like solve, but like you need to solve a problem as the protagonist. But the puzzle isn't like a mental challenge so much as it is like, can you make sense of the world? Mm-hmm. In 3D, it feels like the exploration is still there, and in a lot of ways it is still generally pretty good, but you're not making sense of the world so much as you now just have a bunch of blue keys for blue doors, which means to me that pushes a shift toward combat. So we should probably talk about how the combat, yes, survived moving to 3D.
Not
great.
They ported lock on, and then you can shoot them.
Yeah. Okay. So here's the thing. This to me was actually a thing that might have made me say we can't play this and claim we're doing nostalgia goggles, because if they had fixed, and I do not use that word erroneously, if they had fixed the combat, then I would say this is not the same game. This is not the GameCube game with better graphics. But they didn't. Even though you can move the camera freely and you have twin stick controls of how Samus looks around, it is not, it does not modify the combat. You still have to do everything through lock-on because the enemies are fast and mm-hmm. you shoot slow. So yeah, it is all about timing your shots against their movements. And I just found everything that was not a boss utter chore. All combat that was not big, like set piece boss fights, complete frustrating chore.
Yeah, and boring. Just you're slowing me down in this room and you're annoying, pretty much entirely.
Yeah. I would I would genuinely be curious about playing a version of this game that had no enemies. There was just bosses. Like, you gotta find a way to get just into the boss
rush
room.
Mode.
Well, I still want the exploration, right? I still want to have to, you know, platform through the environments, but doing what I feel like is really, really subpar combat with really, really a suboptimal camera for platforming just led, like, I don't know, man, like 9 out of 10 deaths were felt like I could legitimately be like, that was the game's fault. Like, I couldn't see what was going on. I couldn't tell what was happening. I thought I was standing on this part of the platform, and Samus would have been able to, like, look down at her feet. But I can't do that without tilting my entire upper body at the waist.
So right? Like, it's just VR. VR Metroid.
Yes. Like, I do. I mean, first-person platforming is so bad that there is actually a reference to it in Tiny Tina's Adventures, which is based on the Borderlands engine, where she sets up a platforming challenge for you. And if you fail twice, she says out loud, yeah, the game's not really set up for that. And then magical platforms fly up out of the ground so that you can just walk across the chasm. And it's like, right. But, and this is what I struggled with is, do you think, and I don't know if I have an opinion on this or not yet. Do you think by 2001, that they should have known that precision platforming did not work in 3D in first person?
Yes.
I think so too.
Yeah. For sure. And especially the field of view. And you don't have any of the modern conveniences that they've now built into the games where, like, you auto grab ledges. Like, Samus cannot grab any ledges, which makes some sense cannot. Having a beam gun, but you imagine, like, she might be able to amble up some things, and she does in some of the later 2D games. It might even be Fusion. It might have been the first one, but simultaneous release. Like, that might have helped, just so when you slip, you would not fall completely. In some of those tall rooms, falling might be minutes of traversal you now have to repeat. I'd rather have a pit that, like, respawns me than having to climb this thing again.
Yeah, especially if you, if what knocked you down was a respawning enemy, or if what knocked you down was an environmental hazard, that it's like, oh, so now I have to do all of this stuff that in no way prepares me for dealing with that thing just to get back to that thing, right? There's my version of cycle time is like, is the way you knocked me back going to set me up for success when I arrive back at this challenge? And the answer for platforming failures is often no, because it's just the game engine.
And this is where the, to use another George term, the cycle time of your attempt at a room, the cost in 3D is so much higher because, you know, tall rooms that you have to jump forever in are a Metroid staple. It's like very common in pretty much every single game. And some of those rooms are sparse enough that you can fall pretty far and get pretty mad about it. But the tools in the 2D game and the amount of time it takes to recover is so much shorter, especially if you have proper high jump and space jump. But even without that, it's just the 2D traversal is like less than a minute. You're back to where you were. And in this game, when you fall like that, depending on the actual pathway you have to take to get up that high, it might be through other rooms. It might be like the game only has a memory one room away that you've cleared. And so you might have discovered this viscerally yourself. Like, if you're just one room away, you can go back and you don't have to refight everything. But if you go through one single additional door, it's a total goldfish about everything.
Yeah. And so I do want to comment on that. But first, I want to say this is another shortcoming of 3D platforming, which is in 2D platforming, I feel like unless you've made a bad game, it's obvious whether or not you can make a jump, right? In 3D platforming, it's not, because you can't see your feet, right? So like in Super Mario Brothers, like going all the way back, if you see a chasm, one, you have to clear it because that's how you proceed in the game. But two, you know, did I jump at the last possible second? Like, was I on the end of the platform before I took flight? In 3D, unless you are staring at your feet, which I have done, I have run at a platform looking down, so I knew I jumped at the last possible second, which just feels stupid. It feels like then this is bad level design, right? Because there's world design, and the world design in this game is amazing, but sometimes the level design breaks down, and to their credit, it's not often. It's not often that they're asking you to make a maximum length double jump from point A to point B, but it's not never.
Yeah.
There are some times where you are essentially just trying to time it by feeling like, okay, did the railing go out of my peripheral vision, or did this spot on the wall that I knew I could see before I fall down, like, is that still in my vision? And then I'm going to use that to time a jump. And it's just dumb. Like, it's dumb, right? I know, like, a lot of people like to crap on 2D side-on games because they're like, well, but you have all this information about what's behind you wouldn't have. And it's like, yeah, that's the trade-off
choice.
It's the trade for peripheral vision. Like, what a real person can see in first person and what a video game shows you in first person is like you have a terrible neck injury. Like, a 2D side-on may be more information than you can really perceive about the world, but it's not as much more as you think when you really actually look at how quickly you can dart your eyes around and, like, just look over your shoulder without turning your entire body around. Like, the 2D side-on is, I think, closer to realistic than first person in most video games.
And field of view is a thing, and this game doesn't have an egregiously bad field of view for the genre, but it is way more of a tunnel than real life. And, you know, even if you turn all the HUD transparency all the way up so you can, like, see a little more, like, it's not going to make a difference to what you're complaining about, though. Still not. I was thinking of trying to come up with a Rob Liefeld joke, the comic book artist who never drew feet, even in scenes where you should be able to see feet. Like, he designed this game.
I knew I recognized that name. I was like, why do I know that name? Yes.
Yeah, platforming, and even like the grappling hook just doesn't feel very fun. And there's like three rooms in the entire game that use it, and it's just kind of like basically a blue door key at that point. And I think that, like, that's just kind of like what happened to this game. And it's like they did a really good job, and there's just these trade-offs, and they add up a little bit, and it's just, it's not a bad game, but it's just kind of so I have a few others. Oh, the map. Okay, I'm gonna say one word for the map: echochrome. The map is another case of, I think they made a lot of decent decisions, and it's just harder to use flat out in every dimension. Sorry for that.
well done.
Did you have echochrome happen to you when you're rotating the map and you're like, I can no longer tell what's in front or behind anymore?
Yes. I had several, and I also, like, almost universally rotated it different than what I wanted.
Yeah.
So not only was I trying to orient myself, but then I would, you know, like, if you were holding a physical model and you were like, I want to look at the bottom now, you would never accidentally turn it to the top. Like, that just wouldn't happen.
I've never accidentally jumped when I'm trying to turn a faucet on, but I do that in games.
Yes, exactly. Right. So, like, something about the map controls, I was like, maybe because I was disoriented by trying to figure out, like, where I was and where I needed to go, the little compass in the corner kind of helps, and you can very clearly see the green cone with the little red nose of Samus.
It's clear. Like, it's kind of insane, but it's clear.
It is. It's a choice, but you can tell exactly where she is and where she's facing. But there were so many times where I was just like, okay, wait. And so now I need to go from here to here, and then I need to wait, but am I facing the right way? Like, and so I would, like, open the map and close the map and open the map and close the map a lot. The one thing I thought the map did exceptionally right was every single room is named. Every single room has a
very
unique
Google
name.
Friendly.
Well, I took notes. Like, I actually, I would, because, and I don't think this is a games literacy thing, like this would be a little unreasonable to expect someone with like a super low games literacy, but I would go into a room and I would see the obvious thing that I don't yet have the MacGuffin for. And I would write down like this room in this biome had these MacGuffins, right? And that made backtracking. Unfortunately, I didn't start doing that until I'd been playing for a couple hours, but that made backtracking like a little less of a chore in some ways. Cause I was like, at least I know where there is something interesting.
Yeah. And the game just doesn't do the extra step of filling that into the map for you. Other than doors, they'll give you the doors, but they won't give you any other.
They do. Yeah. It would be nice since a lot of the items, not, I don't know, a portion of like the missile upgrades and things are just hidden behind an ability. It's not, you could see it. It's right there. I just can't get to it.
Yeah.
It would be nice if you could scan it and like mark it. Like there is a missile upgrade yeah. in this room, put it on the map.
Yeah, that's, I have a note about exactly that. Yeah. And this is just like, so the map was just a confusing interface for the reasons we both said, like it spun the way I didn't expect it to spin. And also I'm getting vertigo from trying to figure out the perspective on it. And it's, you know, I don't want to overplay. Like I wasn't like desperately in pain over this, but there were times where, and so like a few other informational challenges with the map. So there's a couple spots in the game where you take like an elevator, or there's just kind of like a skip, or like for whatever reason, they're like, this passageway pops out here. And I found that like harder to like read quickly than it should have been. And I don't know exactly what the design fail is, because they have like some like a symbol and maybe color coded for it.
Yeah, but there's like a little green up arrow and like orange down arrow or something.
It was enough of a like too vague for me that I would have appreciated just like A goes to A, buddy, like would have done the job. And yeah.
Well, even the elevator names, it's like, oh, this will take you to like Talon Overworld West. And it's like, right, but there isn't a room on the Talon Overworld called Talon Overworld West. So you mean the west side of the Talon Overworld.
Yeah. And then now I have to use the compass and reason through which one that probably, like, it doesn't seem like it had to be that confusing and that many different pages you'd have to hop between to be like, where am I going to end up? And is that where I want to go? And so, like, the few options for getting around a little more quickly in this game, namely the elevators, they're just, the information provided is vague enough and I couldn't internalize it fast enough that it just felt like, oh, I keep popping up in the wrong side of this map and I can either just trudge through it now because I'm here or go back down and go to a different elevator. And it just felt like a slog. Like it just wasn't fun. It wasn't the fun kind of exploring. It was, and if you look on a map and you're like, okay, I want to get all the way from here to that part of the map, it was just a chore to be like, okay, like let's plan this road trip. And then you get there and you're like, oh, I don't have the right beam.
Well, and they like this was where things started to break down for me, because I didn't say this at the top, but I actually didn't finish this game, not because we didn't have time. I quit. I got to a point where I was like, I'm right at the end. I have this one more boss, then I will get the Phazon suit, and then I will have to go do the round the world tour to collect the Chozo artifacts, and then I will fight the final boss. And I was like, no. I messaged you and I was just like, dude, I can't. Like, I don't want to, because the Phazon mines, I think, is that the name of that area, right?
Yeah.
There's a lot of space pirates down there. A lot of space pirates down there, because that's where all like the science facilities are, right? That's where they're doing research on how to like make super soldiers and stuff. So to the point you made a minute ago about goldfish memory, when you go two rooms away, don't get lost in the Phazon mines, because you will do 10 times as much combat. And the combat's not good or fun. And I find the color matching gets really irritating. And where this started to break down the game for me is when I realized it was ruining not just my mood, but the mood. As in, slogging back through this room where I know there are several space pirates hanging from the ceiling and they're this color because I've been through this room 10 goddamn times in the last 5 minutes. So I'm going to have on the visor and I'm going to have the right color set, and then I'm going to shoot them once and then they drop down and then they run over and then I shoot them again. And I have to do that 4 or 5 times because there's 4 or 5 of them hanging from the ceiling. I was like, this is no longer moody and atmospheric and scary. Yeah, I am now like a brutal murderer trying to eradicate their entire population. I'm a psychopath at this point.
And it's a to-do list you got to slog. You're not even like, as a psychopath, you're not in it. You're just I don't even want to do the dishes again.
Yeah. And then knowing that the Chozo artifacts were coming up, I was like, okay, I understand that this is like, this game is super lore heavy and that doing this is like the physical manifestation of the lore, but there's no quick travel. There's nothing. Like, if you want to get from here to there, you have to walk, right? Mm-hmm. As the map opens up, sometimes like areas connect in multiple ways, which helps you a little bit, but not that much.
No.
And there's nothing. You just got to walk. And that means if something you forgot is in the Phazon Mines, guess what? You're doing those like 20 combat encounters with the scary, super tense music again. And it just destroys the atmosphere. It is a mood killer.
Which is kind of a big deal for Metroid. The mood matters. Yeah, it's, I don't really have a good defense because the combat is not fun. Like you said, it's not the worst I've ever played, but that's really faint praise. the one sound thing I saved for this was, did you notice or did you read about there being a sound when you're near a power up?
Oh, no. No, what, once I know I'm going to review a game, then I have to go on like media blackout. So
I understand the no research policy. So it was really more a question. Did you notice in the sound design that the game has a particular kind of rhythmic buzzing noise when you're close to a pickup?
How close do you have to be?
Not like right next to it, but like if you're across the whole room, you won't hear it. So somewhere in between.
Yeah, I don't recall.
It's subtle. And maybe it's
like too subtle.
And maybe that's okay that it's subtle, because like it's, a lot of them are optional. They're secrets. They don't want to just have a giant billboard next to every single one. They definitely call out a few of them quite a bit. But yeah, like 20 years later, I've never knew this sound was because you're close to an item, or probably mostly just didn't notice the sound at all. Or if I did, thought it was just part of the atmospheric music or something. And that, like, I don't know, I just kind of blew my mind 21 years after this game came out to be like, oh, they had a sound for like when you're close to something that you can get.
Well, and in a game where you have multiple visors, and I don't think any of your visors help you spot hidden items, like, you're going to rely entirely on this kid has the sound up so loud, the volume up on their TV so loud that they're going to pick up on the super subtle cue. Like, what a weird thing to not have considered, right? Especially when the game right before this one has an entire tool visually for finding missile upgrades in the wall.
Yeah, and like presumably the X-ray or thermal visor will let you see those things, but I don't switch to those unless I have to, because it's just like annoying.
It's nauseating.
Yeah.
It's really nauseating.
It's very like, JPEG artifacty on some of the rooms.
To me, it was the lag, right?
Yeah.
It's like in every movie or TV show where someone is, they get poisoned or they're drunk or high, and you see first person, there's like, they move. And
like the unsolved mystery ghost trail.
Yeah. Yeah. The field of view moves, but like everything kind of like drags. Okay. When you were a kid, were you a Mac kid or were you a Windows kid?
Mac kid until I discovered gaming PCs.
Okay. Did you, starting in like Windows 95, maybe even 3.1, you could turn on the ghost trail and the cursor?
Yes.
Did you use that?
No. I mean, I played with it and like turned it on to extreme, yeah, and then I turned it off because
right,
I'm
yeah,
not an
but
insane person.
It looked like that, right? And I think
you'd call that a slow shutter in a camera.
Oh, thank you.
Long exposure.
if I were to give them tremendous benefit of the doubt, I would say they made the X-ray and the thermal goggles do that because they don't want you to leave them on.
This is detective mode for
They're disorienting. They obscure other important information. Like you can't really discern where platforms are and where like the corners of the room are and stuff. So I would say like, I would expect that much from these developers. Like they are trying to come up with as many reasons as possible to say, don't just leave detective vision on all the time. It will suck the fun out of everything.
We put the charger on the bottom of the mouse. Don't leave it plugged in.
Okay, that's a little extreme, but yeah, so like I think they did it on purpose, but it does mean when you are out scavenging and you're trying to find those last few missile pickups to get 100%, it's a real chore. Like walk in the middle of a room, stop, listen for the sound, switch between all your visors. Okay, I don't see any walls that look funny. I didn't hear anything funny. I'll go repeat this in the next 1,000 rooms.
Yeah. Definitely not an accessible feature. I don't know if they had any toggles for like just yell at me where everything is in this game.
The only accessibility feature I saw was color related, and I didn't play with it, so I don't know exactly what it does to the environment.
Yeah, I think like I'm starting to repeat myself over and over, but the one last dimension that you made me think of for how the move to 3D has made things slower, take longer, and be more complex for questionable conversion into gaming joy. Like it doesn't convert into no gaming joy. I think it's a pretty good game, but it's just not as efficient of a machine for turning that gameplay into joy as 2D Metroid is for me. And the dimension that the last one that you made me think of was the fight, the combat, which is, you know how long it takes to kill a given enemy that's not a boss in Super Metroid? One,
seconds?
Two, like it's like almost instant unless they have a particular like gameplay reason they block something, they're in a shell, whatever it is. And in this game, it's always many more shots, sometimes many more powered shots, and you got to be aiming at the right part. And some of the, like a lot of this makes sense, but it's a lot of it is like it's just slower. And that I feel like the game just wears on you with how it had to slow everything down and point a bunch of things out and systematize so many different things that are just intuitive in the 2D game. You're just flying around, shooting things, testing things. And, you know, in a very limited way, you have that Breath of the Wild sense of like, I'm going to try to bomb every little part of this. And it doesn't take you 50 hours to do that. It takes you less than an hour to do it. And so you're like kind of excited to do it, and it's fun and it's instant. And this is like, well, if I'm going to do that, I'm going to go like, honey, what's on our calendar? Like, it's just kind of,
you got to block out some time.
And it's enough of a difference that it makes a difference. And I don't know how you could do it without slowing it down in 3D, because it's just, you're going to make people even more sick, or they're just going to miss everything.
Yeah, I mean, I think you could still make regular enemies easy.
Yeah, you could solve that one easy.
Yeah, and save all the combat for
bosses.
It'd
be like Doom 2016. It's just like Murder Fest, and that could be awesome.
You could also not make enemies respawn as long as you're in the same area. Like that to me, like, when should enemies respawn? Elevators. There you go. I just solved that problem for you forever. Enemies don't respawn unless they are necessary, right? Like the in Super Metroid, there's those things you got to freeze and then you shoot them with a grapple beam, you know? So like, yes, okay, they need to respawn if I walk one room away. But otherwise, as long as I'm in the same area, don't make the enemies respawn, right? Because then if I'm thinking about just swatting aside space pirates, because the flora and fauna that try to kill you, it's like, oh, the planet is hostile, right? But the space pirates, presumably there's a fixed number of them. Like, they don't inhabit this planet. They are visiting from their ship, right? So, like, the fact that there are just dozens and dozens and dozens of like annoying color-coded enemies, it kills the mood. The one thing I want to mention, and then I'll be done. If you want to go into whether or not we felt like it held up, I actually really liked the inclusion of all the lore. I found myself reading most things. It gets a little overwhelming in the Phazon Mines when every single computer screen has a logbook on it.
Yes,
and you're in a science lab, so there's computer screens everywhere. But the thing that made me consciously aware of the fact that I was enjoying the lore was two things. Three, if you count, like, I was going out of my way to read most of it. But it was two specific pieces of lore that I encountered. Because, again, I didn't finish the game. One of the screens is talking about, like, they're trying to duplicate Samus's technology because they're on a Chozo planet and Samus's technology is all Chozo technology. So, like, this is an incredible opportunity for them. And one of the things that they tried to duplicate was the Morph Ball. And they talk about how several volunteers died horribly. Yes. And so they have shelved that project to pursue other goals.
That is, like, a lovely note in the game.
Well, I was like, oh, because they are people, right? Like, there may be bad people and they're bad people who do bad things, but like, they're not mindless robots. Like, this is a group of people who have like goals and desires and lives. The one that really sold me is, I wish I'd had time to write down exactly the way it's phrased, but basically it is one of the first ones you encounter, because there's several that are thematically like this, but it's one of the first logbooks you encounter that is like a memo from like a pirate captain to pirate soldiers, like alerting them that you are here and authorizing them to use lethal force to stop you. And the way it was phrased, and the fact that you then see more and more of those, the way they're phrased, they are afraid of you. They refer to you as the hunter, right? Because yeah. You're a bounty hunter, but they don't call you a bounty hunter because I feel like that would be like derisive, right? It's like, mm-hmm. Oh yeah, she's a bounty hunter. Like, oh, she's
a freelancer.
Yeah. She makes her money by like turning in like good and honest pirates, but no, you are the boogie woman to them. Like, they have a society and they believe they are trying to like get by or do whatever it is they think they're doing. And you are this terrifying monster who comes down from the sky and brutally murders them. And what I really loved about that juxtaposition is it gave me the feeling that like in this universe, on this planet, in this situation, everyone is afraid. Samus is afraid because she's alone. The creatures on the planet are afraid because there's like this crumbling society and the like nature is trying to take back over, but there's still people around. So there is
literal poison.
Yeah. There's literal poison oozing out of the planet. And the space pirates are also afraid. Like, this is a world of, it's not terror, right? But it's like, it's a world of like discomfort and disquiet. And I just thought, it was really well executed to like humanize the space pirates in a way that is like reminds you that they're like people inside their metal suits with their fancy guns, but also to reinforce the atmospheric vibe in a way that is probably unique to the Prime games. Cause I don't think any of the 2D games have the lore shoved down. Well, Metroid Dread does it in very concentrated doses.
And Fusion, it's not lore, but you have to talk to that computer 100,000 times.
Right, which they trick you with in Metroid Dread, where you think you're talking to the computer, but actually it's your father.
Ooh.
Spoilers.
So many spoilers for a different game.
So, Are we ready to answer the final question?
Yes.
So for me, I will say whether or not this game holds up. No, it do not hold up because I don't think they ever should have done what they did. Like, I get why they did it, but everybody's losing their damn minds over the prospect of Metroid Prime 4. And I hope the people who are excited for it love it. But I realized, oh God, are they going to modernize it and piss everyone off? Or are they not going to modernize it and piss everyone off? Like, those people waited so long to make the fourth game. Three entire console generations have passed. Yeah. Like, it is.
But not in terms of hardware power.
Not in terms of hardware power. But that is a scary prospect for a designer to be like, do we modernize this thing or not? Right? Like, Doom 2016 was never going to look or play like Doom 1995. But yeah. Metroid Prime 4, you could make an argument that it should play like the trilogy. And I would say, yes, do that. Because then I will know that this is not for me. And this is something for the people who like it. But I settled on a nostalgia monocle because the game's gorgeous. The atmosphere, it's just dripping with atmosphere, except when it gets ruined by the terrible combat, right? The boss fights are still super fun, just like they are in every other Metroid game I've played. Like it's a beautiful art object that is absolutely ruined by the fact that they force way too much combat on you. It's not fun combat. And platforming in first person sucks. So
yeah.
If you don't care about those things somehow, or like most people, if you have nostalgia goggles for this game, Metroid Prime Remastered is no question the best way to play Metroid Prime like a million times over. If you are like me and you passed on this series, I would say continue passing, which I feel so bad about because it is a beautiful art object that is just not fun to play. Watch a speedrun.
Yeah, I don't think I have much to add. I mean, I'm similar. I'm a monocle, and I think I was a bigger fan of this game before getting more critical about it in this replay. And it's like, it's a lovely remaster. They didn't just up-res it. They like redesigned all the art pretty much. It's still silky smooth. It's like, as a sleek sports car version of this game, like it rips around the track really well. I've been playing a lot of Gran Turismo lately. but it's still kind of like, do I want to drive a car all the time? No, maybe not. And so like, if you know your answer to that question, it's what it is. And it's like its best self, but it's still itself. And, you know, I don't think it's a bad game. I don't think it's a bad game at all. But I do think if you are hooked on 2D Metroid for the particulars of what it's doing in 2D, then I think you're going to find a lot of compromise making that a 3D game. And maybe they can surprise me and solve these problems with new design decisions, or, you know, sidestep them through some other decisions. But it's still not like, I think I told you before we recorded this, if they offered me a 2D and a 3D Metroid, I would take the 2D Metroid every single time if they're going to make a new game.
The curtain falls, the music plays, the credits roll, then it all fades to black, and you're left by yourself. The fanfare is gone, there's no player two there by your side to share victories won. But as you slowly progress down the hall to your bed, a few great events leak back into your head from the time that you spent traversing the land, battling evil, fighting the darkness, just sword in hand. Your memories creep in with the edge of a smile. You realize again what you've lost for a while. You never think back much less on how you saved the day than on all the experience gained.
Who cares? People know that that's not.
the most damning thing I could say about this game is the combat reminded me of Ocarina of Time.
That's what they did, except you have a gun.